This next story comes from Joyce Meyer. She's a woman preacher down in the States, and so I'm blaming her. There was a husband shopping center that was opened where a woman could go to choose from among many men to be her husband. It was laid out in five floors with the men increasing in positive attributes as you ascended up the floors. And the only rule was once you opened a door to any floor, you had to choose a husband from that floor. And you couldn't go back down to the floor before. So two girlfriends came to the husband shopping center, and they entered in, and they found the first door saying, "These men have jobs and love kids." The woman said, "Wow, that's better than having no jobs and not liking kids, but let's go on to the next floor and see what's there." The second floor says, "These men have high-paying jobs, love kids, and are extremely good-looking." Said the girls, "but I wonder what's further up." So on the third floor, this sign said, "These men have high-paying jobs, are extremely good-looking, love kids, and help with the housework." "Wow," they said. "But tempting as it is, let's look at the next floor." On the fourth floor, it says, "These men have high-paying jobs, love kids, extremely good-looking, help with the housework, and have a strong romantic streak." And, "Oh, mercy," they said, "just think. But what must be waiting further on?" So up to the fifth floor they go, and the sign says, "This floor is just to prove that women are impossible to please. Thank you for shopping, and have a nice day." There was a couple lying in bed, and the husband says, "I'm going to make you the happiest woman in the world." And the wife says, "I'll miss you." Just to be even. Sometimes in the Bible, we look at it as a book of rules and regulations and commandments and genealogies, lineages, and can be actually quite boring depending on which book you read. You know, every book has something to share with us and to enlighten us on who God is and how he works with people. But other times, there's some human interest stories that kind of can capture our attention. And today is one of those stories where we're departing a little bit from kind of historical stuff into a story of maybe romance. And so we're looking actually chapter 24 of Genesis, and it centers around Abraham, who we've been talking about, the founder of God's people, who were called the children of Israel, which Israel was the name of Abraham's grandson. And they were also known as the Jews, named after his great-grandson from the tribe of Judah. But today we're looking at the promise of God to Abraham, who's promised to make him into a nation. And it's just not happening yet. He has one son in his old age, and this son doesn't have a wife. How are we going to create a nation if my son's not even married? So this chapter centers around Isaac finding a wife. So I'm going to read beginning at verse 1. I'm going to skip through it a little bit because there's some repetitive verses in here. But here we go. "Abraham was now a very old man, and the Lord had made him rich. He was successful in everything he did. One day, Abraham called to his most trusted servant and said to him, 'Promise me in the name of the Lord who rules heaven and earth that you won't choose a wife for my son Isaac from the people here in the land of Canaan. Instead, go back to the land where I was born and find a wife for him among my relatives. The Lord of God of heaven who took me from my father's house and from the land of my family, who spoke to me and swore to me, saying, to your descendants, I will give this land. He will send an angel before you, and you shall take a wife for my son.' And soon after that, the servant loaded 10 of Abram's camels with valuable gifts, and he set out for the city in northern Syria, where Abraham's brother Nahor lived. When he got there, he let the camels rest near the well outside of the city, and it was late afternoon, the time when the women came out for water. The servant prayed, 'Lord, you are the God of my master Abraham. Please keep your promise to him and let me find a wife for Isaac today. So there's a saying in the Middle East that said, when a son has attained the age of 20 years, his father, if able, should marry him. And then take his hand and say, I have discipled you, I have disciplined you and taught you and married you. Now I seek refuge with God from your mischief in the present world and in the next. In this culture, a father's obligation was to find a suitable wife for his sons. Abraham had allowed Isaac actually to be well past marrying age. Not only was he past well past 20, it says that he was 37 years old when his mom passed away. And so this particular story occurs when he is now 40 years old. So it was twice the age that he should have been when he should have been married. You don't have to raise your hands, but have you ever watched that show, that like The Bachelor? I see a couple of hands. Okay, you admit it. Okay. Well, this guy would have been the most eligible bachelor in the land. He was not only strong and good-looking, loyal to his family, but he was uber-wealthy. In fact, his dad had his own militia that defeated a conglomeration of three kings to rescue his nephew Lot at one point. This guy, when you saw his tents and entourage, you would have thought there's a small town here. He had all the flocks and the herds, the servants, the militia, all of that. And this son was going to inherit it all. Some people think that there was a reason why it was so late that he was married. And one was because the bond between Isaac and his mom would have been really strong, possibly unusually strong, and a young wife would have found it pretty difficult, more than usual, to take her place alongside of her husband. This was the son Isaac born in the late age of his parents. And for 37 years, he had his mom around, and he would have been the spoiled brat. The heir apparent, all of that, and no one probably would be good enough for the mom. She had passed away 3 years early. The second problem in finding a wife for Isaac is that this woman was going to be in the lineage of the Messiah. Jesus Christ would come from the descendants of the wife that Isaac would marry, and couldn't just be anybody. It needed to be someone that God had chosen and picked out. And she couldn't come from the tribes around, the pagan tribes, the Canaanites and the Hittites. They had abominable worship practices to foreign gods and idols. And it was disgusting the kinds of things that they could do in their worship practices. And so God didn't want his people to have anything to do with them. So Abraham sends his servant Eliezer back to his homeland to find someone that was of the same faith, the same customs, the same priorities, and the same values. So that when she marries his son, there would be kind of, I would say, smooth sailing, but there'd be the least amount of trouble and difficulties. It would have been easier to find a local wife among the pagan Canaanites, but Abraham was not willing to consider a wife that was not of the same kind of heritage and priorities. And it speaks to a verse in the New Testament in 2 Corinthians 6:14 that says, "Do not be unequally yoked together with unbelievers. For what fellowship does righteousness have with lawlessness? And what partnership does light have with darkness?" There's a good reason why God commands his people to not be unequally yoked. And that's, of course, an agrarian term where you had oxen tied together with a yoke across their necks and they would pull the plows together. And to have a strong oxen with a weak horse, they're just going to kind of go in circles. You need to have someone that has a similar strength and will to pull together in a straight line. And so unequally yoked is a term just meaning someone who is not your equal or not the same in priorities and values. And he wants his people to be marrying and partnering up with those who have the same kind of faith. Same kind of background in the Lord. And so he prevents his people from following after other tribes with idols. In fact, that's what got the people of Israel ruined in the end. They cohabitated, they intermarried with the Canaanites and the Hittites and the tribes around until so much they lost their identity. They lost their worship of God. They forgot about him, chased after other idols. That's exactly why 11 of the tribes disappeared in the end. So at the beginning, he's saying, don't do it. Stay faithful. Be committed to those that have the same values and background and same God. I tell you, marriage is hard enough without putting other difficulties in there. So many Christians think that they know better than God, and they think that love is more important than following God's directions in their life. They believe as long as you love someone, it doesn't matter if they're a Christian or not, or if they come from a different cultural background, if they have a different family values. It doesn't matter as long as you're madly in love. It'll all work out. And I've seen families where that was the dream, that was the goal, and it just didn't happen. There was so much different than there's a pull in different directions. There wasn't a unity of heart and mind and soul moving in the right direction. God didn't bless marriages where he is not the center. They just have to make their way because he's not put in the middle of the marriage. God discourages dating non-Christians or marrying non-Christians because he can't be the center of that marriage or of that home or of that relationship, no matter how nice the unbeliever is. Believers in the scriptures are seen as righteous, whereas unbelievers are not. Believers are designated as the light of the world, whereas unbelievers are still in darkness. Believers are born again, destined to live with God forever. Unbelievers can't even comprehend spiritual things. They're not spiritually alive yet. They haven't given their life and heart to Christ. The Spirit of God is not in them as it is in a believer. And so in a home where it's unequally yoked, there's divided loyalties. There will always be conflicting priorities and values. There, often the believing spouse has to choose between God and the unbelieving spouse in situations, and it's always a bit of a fight and a compromise. Also, the children will have an impossible choice of which parent to follow regarding their relationship with God. One will be pulled in one direction and one in the other direction. So Paul says in the New Testament, sometimes you are in that kind of a situation, and it's okay, Paul says, stay. Stay if you're unequally yoked. Pray hard. Live a life that demonstrates God's love and his grace and his forgiveness in your own life in hopes of having God come into the home and change your spouse's life. So we see Isaac here, 40 years old, the great aim of his life. And his service in terms of the promises of God to Abraham were to have kids. And he's not even married. And so this story is saying God is starting to continue in the promise to Abraham of finding a suitable wife for Isaac so that the promise can continue to build a nation. And I think he must have been tempted, as his father had been, to take matters into his own hands. I'm sure there's lots of pretty women around where he was, and any one of them could have thrown themselves at his feet because he was like, what a great marriage this is going to be. I mean, I'm going to be set for life if I marry this guy, and think of all the influence I could have, and my whole family can be blessed because of this. But he stayed true to his commitments to his family. He trusted his dad to do the right thing. And everything was going to depend on his choice, whether or not to take matters into his own hands or just be patient. I can't even imagine if you're supposed to be married at 20, now you're 40 years old, you're kind of like, Dad? Like, Dad? I'm kind of lonely. Like, when are you going to get busy and find me a wife? And now is the time. We assume that Abraham sends his most faithful servant, Eliezer, who asked God for a sign to show him who the right woman is going to be. And the sign wasn't a weird, strange sign. It was a simple sign. He could have asked something silly like, let the woman who stumbles on the first step in the walkway be the one, or the woman who has an orange flower in her left ear is the right one. But what he asks is actually a sign that reflects the character and the nature of the woman herself. It reflects her good-heartedness and readiness to show hospitality to strangers. The sign would be, the one who offers water to my camels will be the one that we will choose. And so in Genesis 24, verse 13, he goes on to say, The young women of the city will soon come out to this well for water, and I'll ask one of them for a drink. If she gives me a drink and then offers to get some water for my camels, I'll know she's the one you have chosen and that you have kept your promise to my master." He's speaking to God. While he was still praying, a beautiful, unmarried young woman came by with a water jar on her shoulder. Her name was Rebekah, the daughter of Bethuel, the son of Abraham's brother Nahor and his wife Milcah. Rebekah walked past Abram's servant, who then went over to the well and filled her water jar, and she started back. And Abram's servant ran to her and said, "Please let me have a drink of your water." "I'll be glad to," she answers. Then she quickly took the jar from her shoulder and held it while he drank. After he had finished, she said, "Hey, now I'll give your camels all the water they want." And she quickly poured out water for them, and she kept going back for more until his camels had drunk all they'd wanted. Simple sign, but it speaks to character. And God is always about character. God has assignments for those who are faithful and will follow what he has to say. So here we learn also, it's okay to ask for a sign. Have any of you ever asked God for a sign? I see a few hands. I've asked God for a sign when it's time to make a really monumental decision, life-changing decision that can affect my family. And God, show me that this is what, you know, the right way to go. It's okay. God says that if any of you lack for wisdom, you should ask God. It will be given to you. God is generous and won't correct you for asking. Lots of people in the Bible ask God for a sign. They just weren't sure. They weren't confident that their decision was the right one. So they said, "God, show me that the decision I'm making is right or wrong. Keep me from making a bad decision." So everything unfolds just like the servant hopes it would. The chosen woman, Rebekah, goes back with him. I'm skipping over some verses. You remember he had 6 camels laden with precious gifts, jewels, gold. And so her dad got a truckload of valuable jewels and whatnot. And she agreed to come. And I think probably her grandfather, Abraham's brother, would have said, "Hey, I know Abram. He's a good guy. He's generous. He's firm. He's super wealthy, but he will be kind to you." I can't even imagine that his son would be any different than he would be. So I think probably they had a talk, convinced her that this was probably a really great decision for her. But keep in mind, she was leaving her homeland, leaving her family, her friends, everything she knew. She didn't even know exactly where she was going. But God had worked in her heart already. God had prepared her for this moment, that there was something maybe exciting coming up. And when Eliezer shows up and says, "You're the one," God has chosen to be a part of his ultimate plan, she willingly goes without a lot of ado. Now keep in mind that this book, Genesis, was written by Moses some hundreds of years later. And all of these accounts are passed down verbally to generation after generation after generation. And I kind of think that maybe Moses is a little bit of a romantic, because as the story unfolds, I'm just picturing, I don't know, I've honestly not read a Harlequin romance novel. Honestly, my mom had lots of them. But anyway, I see this kind of working out in that way. What happens here next, I can kind of picture the scene in a movie. Verse 63 of chapter 24. Isaac is going outside of the encampment. He hears that Eliezer has been successful. Word has come back. They're on the way home. And now he's a bit nervous. Is this woman going to be pretty? Are we going to be compatible? Is she going to, you know, help me in my life? Will she be a good companion? And so it says, Isaac went out to meditate in the field in the evening, and he lifted his eyes and he looked, and there the camels were coming. Strong, healthy, hardworking, not to mention extremely wealthy man, went out in the evening light, just as the sun was setting. In that in-between time between day and night, and perhaps he was pondering his future, perhaps he was wondering, you know, who is this woman going to be like? His future was about to be revealed. He hoped and he prayed, and then he looks up with anticipation, and in the distance he sees these camels kind of lumbering towards their camp. in the distance. His eyes scan each of the riders. He sees the male figures on the camels and the supplies. And then there's this outline of a woman on the camel. And he's thinking, that's got to be her. I wonder what she's like. I hope this is going to work out. Could this be the wife he'd been praying for and wondering about? The one God had chosen for him. His heart begins to pound. He doesn't know what to do. He starts walking towards the camel train as they come. Meanwhile, Rebecca, having left her family and friends in homeland, maybe the campfires along the way, it probably took several days to make this journey. Eliezer and the servants were talking about Abraham, about how he chased down these armies and rescued his son Lot, how he made a mistake of going to Egypt and lied about his wife and got an Egyptian woman pregnant and had a kid and it didn't really work out, and how Isaac was such a strong worker and nice guy. I mean, there's the stories they must have told her to kind of give her an idea of what she's getting into. Probably told her about the covenant God had made with Abraham and how his son Isaac was a part of that divine plan to be a blessing to the world. Probably would have mentioned that his mom had just died a couple of years earlier, and he's really kind of ready to get on with life and create a family. And it says in verse 64, Rebecca, she looks up, and when she saw Isaac, she got off of her camel and says, "Who is this man walking in that field to meet us?" Kind of like, is this my husband? Is this my betrothed? She hopes he's going to like her, that life was about to change forever for her, and you just hope it's going to work. It's a very human interest story about the most fundamental relationship people have in life after our relationship with God himself. The marriage relationship is the most impactful, the most beautiful, the most important relationship people have. Your marriage partner will impact you even more than your mother and father over time. So I've lived some 20 years with my folks and then some 35 years with my wife now. And I can tell you that I'm not the person I was when I was 20. I'm very much different, and my wife has had a lot to do with that. They become our soulmate, our best friend, our confidant, our advisor and helper and encourager, our partner, our lover, our defender. And Rebecca would become all of this for Isaac, fulfilling God's promises to Abraham, to be a part of this promise of God. She would be listed in the lineage of the Messiah, Jesus Christ. So what do we glean from this particular story about the patriarchs to help us navigate life today? Well, it's pretty simple. First of all, God has a plan, and his plans are always best. It doesn't matter what decision you have, what job you're going to pick, what marriage partner you have, where to live. God has a plan. He knows what's best, and we must seek him and not take matters into our own hands. If you're a single person, wait for God's person. Don't settle for good enough. Don't settle for what's around when God has a person designed for you to complete you. If you are married, God has a plan for you too. He has a plan for your family. He has a plan to bless you as you work together, to serve him together, husband and wife. Being involved in ministry together, serving together, going on mission trips together, whatever it is, your home can be a powerhouse of God's activity when he's in the middle of your life and in your home, it's particularly with your kids. Second, don't become impatient with God. Poor Isaac waited 20 years past his date to find the right woman. But it was the right woman. And he didn't settle for good enough. He didn't settle showing lack of faith. He didn't settle and find someone else that could have fulfilled the role but wasn't God's choice. I've heard many times in my life, it's far better to be alone and single than to be alone in a bad marriage. Remain faithful in the in-between time, between now and when God finds the person for you. And we have a number of singles in our church, and sometimes it's frustrating. I can't get a date. I can't find the right person. Where do I go? Should I go to another church? Should I do the online app? Like all these things that people try to find the spouse, and sometimes it's, you know, how much have you been praying about it? How much have you included God in this decision? Have you been seeking God's will for you in this decision? Don't You waste your in-between time. Use it to become a person of integrity, to be a person of with good values and strengths in your job. Find a house. Find a life that will be worthy of bringing a woman into your life and into your home. The in-between times can be freedom from distraction and responsibility, but they can be used from working on yourself and your own discipline, your own faith, digging deeper in your relationship with God. You could be a man of God that marries a woman of God and has a beautiful relationship and home together. The time between singleness and marriage can be very valuable if you use it wisely. Some simple truths that we can glean from this passage. First, if you honor God, He will honor you. Take time to remember that God is in charge, has a plan, and wants to bless you, wants to show you the best way through life. Second, trust in God's provisions. He will provide beyond your expectations. You think you have a list that that you want matched? Well, God has a list too. And His list is better than yours. Some of our lists are very selfish and self-centered, and He's got other plans to bring glory to Himself through your marriage, through your home, through your kids. Ask God what's on His heart and mind. And God blesses faithfulness. He guides those who act with integrity. Don't cut corners. Don't take matters into your own hands. Don't try and help God do His job, because we always mess up. The last thing I want to mention is that, you know, marriage is so important to God. It is a priority with Him. If you get that wrong at the beginning, then your life is going to be making up for lost time all the time. It's going to be trouble. And I say that because the church itself, us, we are called the bride of Christ. We are the bride that He's coming back to take one day to be with Himself. He does everything to care for His bride, to protect her, to provide for her, to love her, and He's going to come back and say, now's the right time. It's a beautiful picture. And we're in the in-between time between now and when Christ comes back as the groom to take His bride to be with Him in heaven forever. May He find us ready and pleasing in His sight. Would you bow with me in prayer? And ask our worship team to come up. Father God, interesting story. And the details that You've included here put personality to these characters, reveal their hopes, their dreams, their fears, just like we have. And in the midst of it all, Your plan comes together. Your plan to bring a Messiah was dependent on Isaac's choice to be obedient, to be faithful, to remain in Your hands and have faith that You would work things out. And I pray, God, that we would have that same kind of character and value. We wouldn't rush ahead of You, trying to help You out with what You would promise to do for us. Let us be on our knees. Let us meditate. Let us go out into the field and just commune with You and ask God what You're doing. And in time, in Your right time, You will bring it all about. Thank You for this day, for this message. Simple truths, but life-changing nonetheless. I pray this in Christ's name. Amen.